Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. And today we have a very special guest. In fact, our Washington-based Exopolitics advisor, Stephen Bassett, who is a leading advocate for ending the 62-year government-imposed truth embargo regarding an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. He is a political activist, commentator, and columnist. He is the executive director of the Paradigm Research Group and the Political Action Committee, XPAC, creator of the Paradigm Clock, and executive producer of the X Conference. His work has been extensively covered by the media, and Steve has a number of websites. His principal websites are paradigmresearchgroup.org and factsonwashington.org. Welcome, Steve.
It's great to be with you again, Alfred.
You know, Steve, this has been a very, paradoxically, a very active time in exopolitics, and I know that you wanted to cover in our show both the highlights of 2009, and bring us up to date on what your plans are now for 2010, and also what might be occurring with the Obama administration, and also the prospect that we might have a very important vote with the Denver extraterrestrial initiative in August of this year.
Do you want to start with 2009 first?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
And I went ahead and published on the Examiner an article that attracted a lot of attention from our audiences, and that listed the top 10 exopolitics stories of 2009. And it might serve as a guideline for some of our conversation. And maybe I could go through and begin to ask you just about what you think about some of these stories, which I think will tie into what your thoughts are and the message that you want to get out.
However you want to look at 2009, we'll go with your approach,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, well, this was a very active year. Actually, I'll just go through some of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do it quickly. The number 10 story, doing it in kind of the David Letterman countdown fashion, the number 10 story, of course, was the always ubiquitous Latin American UFO activity, and we chose the Salta mothership, which in December of 2009, there was this huge mothership that appeared over the city of Salta, Argentina. And I'm just kind of going to these kind of non-U.S.,
right,
non-North America,
mm-hmm,
non-Europe. Number nine was that Chinese scientists film UFO at the Purple Mountain Observatory and will take 1 year to analyze the data. And we ranked that story because it illustrated the high degree of scientific participation,
mm-hmm,
and openness of the Chinese. And I wonder if you could comment on this, because we don't usually talk about areas outside of Europe and North America.
Well, the event and then 2009 events, the Chinese event was one of the most significant. It's now on my list for very significant exopolitical reasons. China is a relatively closed society, and the amount of news that comes out of it is not anything like the first world countries that we're familiar with. So it was notable. It's notable in general that the Chinese government, nevertheless, is quite interested in UFOs. There's study going on within their own governmental entities, which they don't deny. And there's a great deal of interest in the Chinese people, and they don't have a problem with that either. And if the Chinese government has a problem with what you're doing, they're not shy about letting you know. So that's notable. But there were many sightings in China, and the news stories were getting out. There were sightings over the cities of Shandong, Peking, and Changsha, and others. So that was fine. But there was a major event that occurred on July 22nd, and that was the total eclipse. Now, there's an interesting connection between that and the Latin American story that you just mentioned. There was a total eclipse over Mexico in 91, and included Mexico City. And as a result, millions of people went out to watch it. And at that time, when the sun was occluded, they saw UFOs. They saw something up there. They caught their attention without question, and they filmed it. Mexico's a relatively open society. They sent some of the film into the media, including Jaime Musson, who was the very well-known talk show host, had his own program, 60 Minutes. He showed some of the video, asked for more, thousands more were sent, and thus began the biggest flap in UFO history in Mexico. And that has, of course, extended on till today. It hasn't stopped. And as a result, the interest in the subject and the awareness of the subject throughout Mexico and even and into Central America and to some extent into South America has dramatically grown in those years. You might say that the acclimatization curve was increased. Well, 18 years later, another total eclipse over another country, in this case China, which has a few more people than Mexico. Millions of Chinese go out, the sun is occluded, bingo, something there. Okay, some people took some film of it, cell phone cameras, what have you. The story did come out, it was published. All right, no big deal. It didn't have the kind of follow-up that the Mexico events had because it's China. Except, as you pointed out, on September the 7th, an announcement came through the Chinese press. It got published in the English language media that the Purple Mountain Observatory had filmed that event for 40 minutes. And we can assume that the camera being used by one of their national observatory telescopes was not a cell phone camera. And they also indicated they're going to be studying the film. This is interesting because, first of all, if they didn't want that story out, it wouldn't have come out. The Chinese government didn't want anybody to know that they'd filmed that event. They wouldn't have said anything. And so the fact that this was announced, the fact that they said they were going to be studying this film, to me was a statement from China back to the West that, you know, we're aware of this thing, these issue too. We know what's going on. We're following this. And perhaps we will take independent action on this matter, which is to say we will disclose the ET presence, which you can bet the Chinese are fully aware of. So that was one of the most important events of 2009.
Right. Now, moving on, there are two other stories. Sort of the top eight story and the top seven story might have a relation. The number seven story was ET UFO researcher Gary McKinnon's continued battle against extradition to the U.S. And right now, where that stands is that Gary McKinnon's lawyer has filed a last stand appeal to the High Court in the U.K. from the Home Secretary's decision not to block McKinnon's extradition on the grounds that it violates the European Convention on Human Rights. The other story, of course, was the story of NASA's decision in the L-Cross mission to use a kinetic weapon to bomb the moon.
Well, let's talk about McKinnon.
Okay.
I mean, you brought it up. That's on my list. It's one of the most important things of 2009 because the McKinnon case really heated up. It became even more media coverage of it in 2009. Because he's reaching the end of his, quote, extradition appeals. Now, this is a very interesting case. I've talked about it. I'm happy to talk about it some more. The McKinnon case, who is the man who's now 40, was a computer intruder back in 2001, cruising around some computers, including NASA, using off-the-shelf software, nothing fancy, just some password manipulation. It was in 2001, after the 9/11, got sort of connected in that time frame. So the U.S. was clearly hypersensitive, and he was easily caught. Okay, now, what's happened since is the United States has now conducted an 8-year extradition campaign to bring him to the United States and try him here under strong homeland security laws with very draconian penalties. He's resisted, and the result is an enormous amount of bad publicity and press for the U.S. and the U.K. Celebrities are now lining up behind him, sports figures. It's a PR fiasco for the United States. And it raises some very odd questions, is what is going on here with Gary McKinnon? And my thoughts are this. First of all, your listeners need to understand that the United States' national defense and military systems, computer systems, are under attack 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, thousands of attacks a month, maybe even a week. I'm not sure. I'd have to check, but it's a huge number. And these attacks are coming in from all over the world, including foreign countries like North Korea. Highly sophisticated technology and software and, you know, top-of-the-line computer wizards are trying to get into our systems. And we spend billions of dollars defending these systems against these attacks. All right. Now, 2 points immediately come to mind. First of all, if that's true, if we are at attack and we are spending this kind of money, how is it that a relatively amateurish computer hacker with off-the-shelf software from Best Buy or whatever the hell is able to cruise into some computers and do allegedly $700,000 worth of damage?
Now, one source stated, and this is a very, quote, McKinnon has denied causing any damage, arguing that he accessed open, unsecured machines and disputes the financial loss claimed by the U.S. as concocted in order to create a dollar amount justifying an extraditable offense.
I think it's more than that. I think the case for how much damage he did is very weak, but nevertheless they have made it. But again, remember, they're spending billions of dollars to defend these computers.
Oh, sure.
Right?
But now, McKinnon reportedly located lists of non-terrestrial officers and ships, which may be of a U.S. or shadow government space fleet, which were funded by black budget unconstitutional sources and hence illegal under U.S. law. So shouldn't it be McKinnon's prosecutors within the military intelligence world? And there's some very funny politics. If you originally the British authorities did not prosecute him, and the most he was going to get was 6 months of community service. Then the same Deputy Attorney General under George W. Bush, who was involved in the 9/11 prosecutions, got involved.
Yeah.
So it seems like a very political, murky type of a deal.
Well, this is what I'm trying to clarify for your listeners.
Yeah.
And we didn't mention, we should mention, because some don't know this, but they could easily find out. Google Gary McKinnon, McKinnon. He and I believe him. He was looking for UFO stuff. He's interested in that. And he found some things he thought were intriguing. He didn't download, make records. But he found some things, and he told the press afterwards. So the UFO connection early on was made with respect to the McKinnon case, and it's remained there all along, well and good. So now they allege he's done a lot of damage, $700,000, and then they want to extradite him to the United States. They've spent a fortune on that over 8 years, probably more than the $700,000 in damage. So what is going on here? The only way I can explain this entire incident is this. The government has decided to use McKinnon as a way to send a message to the hackers out there, not necessarily the high end. We're not talking North Korea. We're just talking about kids and people out there that are interested in this subject. Don't come looking for UFO stuff.
Right.
Now, why would they do that? Well, there's several reasons. One, when people do that, they find something and they talk about it, it puts pressure on the truth embargo, and they're not ready to disclose yet, and it just creates problems for them. And secondly, if they do try to take action against them, the UFO issue gets immediately brought into the press, and that's a pain. And so they're essentially saying, look, they're going to great lengths to send a message, don't come looking for UFO stuff because it's a problem for us right now. We want to deal with it. The message isn't don't hack our computers, because believe me, that message is pointless.
Now,
right?
Steve,
everybody knows you're not supposed to hack a government computer, and they're already under attack from sophisticated countries around the world. Right? So that message is useless. And so they're saying, stay away from UFO stuff. So my guess is, if I had to call how this is finally going to come out, and if this is the way it goes down, it kind of confirms my theory on this, is that just about the time, assuming his last appeal fails, right, one of two things will happen. Either in his very, very last appeal, all of a sudden the UK government will go, okay, you're not going to have to go. You stay here. Or, even if he loses that appeal, at the point that he and his mother and his lawyer, Karen Todner, are on their way to the airplane, Barack Obama will sign some sort of directive squashing the whole thing, and he'll stay in the UK.
Well, let's hope that happens.
Yeah, and so the result is, in other words, they've milked it for everything they can get. They've kept it out there. They've milked the message for everything they can get, but they don't actually want to extradite him. Why? Well, let me tell you why. If they actually bring Gary McKinnon to the United States, whether or not it's in his best interest, and that's a debatable point, they are going to unleash a huge amount of media on this case, and it's all going to have a UFO connection. And the result is it's going to bring the UFO issue out big time. It's going to result in a lot of media interview opportunities for researchers and activists in the genre. And we're going to get some FaceTime. And he's going to become, whether he wants to be or not, a martyr for all those that have been pursuing the truth of this matter for decades. And it's going to be a nightmare. For those in the government that are still opposed to disclosure, it's going to be a nightmare. So I don't know who's running a show down there, at the Pentagon and down in the Secret Empire. But if you know, I think that they're pretty sharp, and they've been very successful in managing the truth embargo for 60 years. But they may be making a huge miscalculation regarding Gary McKinnon. The last thing they want to do, if they're trying to execute an orderly disclosure process, or try to minimize press involvement in inquiries as they move toward that event, the last thing they want to do is bring Gary McKinnon to the United States.
Okay. Let's move quickly because we're really want to leave time for the 2010. So I'm going to join together two stories.
Mm-hmm.
The Vatican opening its windows to extraterrestrials and the UK Ministry of its Defense closing the UFO public desk after 50 years.
Yeah, the Vatican story is very important. What happened here is that a number of years ago, well back 2000, possibly even before, a retired Monsignor, former head of the former exorcist, and known to the Pope, Corrado Balducci, in his retirement, started talking publicly about the Catholic Church's position on extraterrestrials and talking about the history of it and Father Pio and all that, with two fundamental messages: that one, the Catholic Church is not concerned or troubled with the idea of extraterrestrial beings being in the universe with us or even on the planet with us, and secondly, that should be no concern that these entities are demonic. Now, a lot of people thought, well, that's just an old guy blowing off steam. Well, I don't think so. There's no way that he would have been going around talking about those things, given his former positions, without at least the approval implied approval of the Vatican. Well, a couple years ago, Corrado died. Fine. So I guess this gentleman is gone. We won't be hearing more about that. Wrong. In March of last year, the head astronomer and director of the Vatican Observatory, Father Jose Gabriel Funes, gives an interview to the Vatican newspaper, L'Osservatore Romano, in which he basically reiterates everything that Balducci had been saying for years. that the Catholic Church has no problem with extraterrestrials. They would be our brothers and sisters under God, et cetera, et cetera. Now, coming from now a sitting director of their observatory, this is far more powerful than what Balducci was doing. So they just upped the ante. Then the whole thing was repeated again in September when these remarks, possibly with the new interviews, were published in the, by the Catholic News Agency. And then to put the cherry on the chocolate sundae, in the first week of November, the Vatican actually held an astrobiology symposium at the Vatican, bringing in scientists from around the world to discuss the political implications, et cetera, of an ET reality in the universe. Now, this could not be a clearer message. The Vatican is positioning itself on the right side of this issue. It has no intention of making the same mistake it made with the Copernican Revolution and Galileo Galilei. And they're looking to come across and come out pretty well on this, anticipating picking up a lot of Catholics maybe in the post-disclosure world. So the moves of the Catholic Church in 2009 were highly, highly significant and worth noting, and I expect to see more. The MOD action was less important but notable. The UK has been dumping out thousands of UFO files for several years now. Some of those cases that were released have had impact. Most of them are not particularly important, but there's some that are, and they're in those files, and they've been coming out. And every time they release a batch of files, as they move towards the present, I think they may be done now, the last batch, it has generated hundreds of news stories all over the UK and in the US. So it's put a lot of pressure on the truth embargo here, without question. And I thought it also meant that the UK might be one of the candidates for another country to be the disclosure nation. However, in December, an announcement turned up on the MOD website, Ministry of Defense in the UK, that they were closing down the UFO desk, the one that Nick Pope had been on for several years, which really brought him to fame on this issue. It was costing them about £77,000 a year, and they needed to save the money. Okay, fine. The statement they gave was virtually mirrored the standard statement that the U.S. government gives on this issue, namely that this phenomenon doesn't pose a threat, so there's really no need to invest time in it, quote unquote. But they didn't specifically say the phenomenon isn't real, right? Which is what the U.S. does, non-denial. And so they closed down the desk. But then the same announcement indicated that they would continue to release UFO files. Interesting. So really what you have here is that the MOD, which is getting just deluged by inquiries due to the release of those files, just driving them nuts, right, coming in, more UFO sightings than ever, more queries about what they have, was trying to just make it easier on itself by just closing down this desk. Because this idea that, oh, there's a desk studying files is kind of moot. These countries all know there's an ET presence, and we know that there's an ET presence, and we know that they know that there's an ET presence. So they shut down the desk to eliminate a headache, but they sent a message by doing that to the United States. The message was, look, we're releasing files. We are putting pressure on you, but don't worry. We're your closest ally. We're not going to disclose ahead of you. We're not going to be the disclosure nation. We're not going to preempt that from you. All right? That's your call. Fine. But by indicating they were going to continue to release files, they're also saying, but we want this to happen. We want disclosure. We want it out of the way. We need to move on. All right? So that was what I took from that event in December.
Now, moving on to the number three story. Mm-hmm. Which is actually a 2010 story, and that is that on November 27th, which is one of the putative dates that Barack Obama was supposed to, according to Dr. Pete Peterson, a Project Camelot whistleblower, it turns out that what happened on that he said earlier during the year during a Project Camelot interview that was one of the dates that Barack Obama was going to come forth and make the famous speech that there is an extraterrestrial presence.
Right.
Well, what turned out happening, our colleague Jeff Peckman made the report on November 27, 2009, the city of Denver approved, and this is an historic election, a ballot initiative for an extraterrestrial affairs commission, and that election is set for August 10th, I think.
Right, but why are you connecting those two together?
No, I'm saying that's the number three story.
Oh, the number three story. All right, well, yeah. Let's first talk about the predictions, Pete Peterson and all that. Project Camelot is a site that is devoted to providing people to come forward and talk about this issue, particularly if they're insiders or people that have connections, scientists, witnesses, what have you. And there's a lot of stuff there. And I'm sure that – I think some of it's pretty legit and interesting, and I think some of it's not. With respect to any predictions of a specific day, the odds of that being true were low from the beginning. It's an easy manner to start a rumor, whether you want to do it for the hell of it, whether you're simply misinformed, or whether you're the government, you just want to put out a date because you want to sort of muck things up a little bit, sort of inoculate yourself against the real date so that the media doesn't get in your face before you're ready to deal with it. And so these kind of predictions are almost invariably wrong, and that's okay. But what was notable is that prediction by Peterson got a lot of coverage. It really went through the Internet very quickly, got a lot of coverage in the various ways the Internet covers things. And it reflected to me that the level of expectation in the general public regarding disclosure is growing. It's getting larger. And so somebody pops up and says, I hear it's going to happen on such a day, and everybody jumps on and go, okay, and starts spreading the word. So this higher level of expectation, I think, is significant and worth noting. And that's what I took away from that. I never predict, I'm never going to predict the day that's going to happen.
Right.
I talk in more general terms about a window's opening and what should happen.
We'll get to the Barack Obama disclosure issue, which actually is the number one story.
Yeah. That's what I took from that. And we may see more rumors and more false kind of starts.
Okay.
So people shouldn't be shocked at that.
No. Right. But let's focus on the number three story, which I think is a very important story, and that is the actual approval, 10,000 residents of Denver got a ballot initiative on the ballot officially now for August 10th, 2010,
mm-hmm.
for the establishment of an extraterrestrial affairs commission. Right. And I've taken a look at that local law, and it has teeth. And I just would like to get your kind of both historical and practical perspective as to what this means and whether or not we as a community have a chance to get this thing passed.
Oh, yeah. Look, Jeff Peckman is a sharp guy, and he what he's done is all politics is local. Well, in some respects, all exopolitics is local. What he's done is he saw, because he had familiarity with the ballot initiative process, he'd attempted it before, he saw an opportunity to sort of put this issue in play in a smaller market, right, where it's doable. Obviously, the extraterrestrial issue is a global matter, and Denver is not the center of the universe or the center of human agendas, but it offers an opportunity to highlight the issue and bring it out and make it kind of a referendum. This is a brilliant move in his part. Denver, I've lived there many years. Denver sits in the middle of America somewhat. It sits it's really on the cusp between the Midwest and the West. You go west over the Rockies, you're in the West. You go east and you're on the flatlands of Kansas and not many miles. And frankly, the people who live in Denver, about 4,400-some thousand, they're pretty representative cross-section, I think, of America. The state tends to vacillate back and forth between red state, blue state, GOP, Democrat. It's very multicultural. And so we got this city, and he was able to draw a lot of attention to the issue by putting this ballot initiative in play. All right, fine, he got the attention of the press. They already know about it. A lot of articles in the Rocky Mountain News, Denver Post. He even gets on David Letterman. And so now he's got people's attention on this initiative. Excellent. But he goes out, and through they really worked pretty hard. I mean, it was not easy. They got enough signatures. They got it on the ballot. So it will be on the election. So what he now has created is an opportunity for sort of a microcosmic referendum on this issue So if a lot of people vote yes, it's another way of they're saying, and they're doing it anonymously because obviously we have the secret ballot in America, that they believe this is real. And so now this referendum really kind of stands in for everybody in the United States. In a sense, it's kind of like a poll, like we do those polls, only this is much more easy for the media to it's a much more of a media story. So this is a brilliant maneuver. So come August of this year, this ballot initiative is going to take place. Well, here's the deal. This is real simple. We want to win this. All right, now what does winning mean? It means we want it to pass. And it's a simple yes or no vote. Majority of those who vote. Some people may not even vote on it. Fine. If they don't care, let them not vote. But of those who do, if there's more yeses than noes, it passes. Now, this is an August election. This is not the November election. So this will have a lower turnout of a different type of election. November, of course, is the main election. You've got congressional people running and so forth. The cost of running a political campaign or a political race is extremely expensive now. And the cost of statewide ballots is very expensive, particularly if they hit bread and butter pocketbook issues. I mean, you can spend millions of dollars trying to drive a ballot initiative on a state level. On a city level ballot initiative, it doesn't impact pocketbook issues, which this really doesn't. It really doesn't cost much money, I think, to successfully pursue it. And he has done pretty well in the past with very little money. However, it still costs some money to get the message out and make your case. And so I think it's very important that we provide Jeff with enough fundamental resources that he has a good shot to win this initiative. Now, as it happens, under the laws, there is much more flexibility on funding a ballot initiative for a city of Denver than it is for the funding election campaigns for people running for office, particularly federal office. And so the fact is anybody can fund this thing, and there's no limit to it, technically. And they can even be funded from out of the country. I mean, people living non-U.S. citizens can fund it. I find that interesting. That's the case. Now, I set a goal of about $20,000. I think if he can get about $20,000, I think he can do what is necessary to ensure this ballot initiative passes. And so I encourage everyone that would like to see this happen to go to the website for the ballot initiative. It's called the Extra, E-X-T-R-A, extracampaign.org. And there's a donation page there. And send some money to Extra Campaign. So the basics that need to be done to ensure this ballot initiative is relatively publicized and the people know about it so they can vote on it will take place, and we have a good chance to win it. So that's what I have to say about that. If the ballot initiative wins, let me also say, if something major happens like disclosure between now and August, that ballot initiative will pass with flying colors. But should that not happen, then we need to run a proper campaign. And if it does pass in August, it's going to be a pretty substantial media story. It's going to get a lot of coverage. Jeff's going to get a lot of media attention, a lot of interviews, and that's going to be good. There's no question. I'm willing to go to Denver to speak on behalf of the initiative or be part of a fundraiser or whatever, and I'm sure some of the other researchers and activists in the field feel the same way. So that's what we have with that. And we may see other ballot initiatives begun in other cities. But remember, it takes time. So you start one today, it may not turn up in the election until 2012. So from the standpoint of the immediate advocacy process, what we've got is Denver. And that's a lot, and that's enough. So let's pursue it.
Great. Now, Steve, we're about to go into the top two stories, one of which is the mother of all stories, which is Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
We would like to extend this program into extra time. Do you have time to stay with us?
Oh, of course.
Oh, great, great, good. Now, the number two story, and actually you were there for part of it at the first European Congress of Exopolitics when we had former DOD scientist Arthur Neumann and Master Sergeant Bob Dean both confirm the existence of teleportation Teleportation to Mars to meet with a project on a project with extraterrestrials there. Bob Dean talked about teleportation from California to project offices in Pine Gap in Australia. Later, another independent whistleblower, Andrew Bashago, who was a child participant in Project Pegasus, confirmed independently his participation in teleportation and also in time travel. So the bottom line is the number two story is that time travel and teleportation are confirmed by independent whistleblowers. And we had Dr. Anderson, David Anderson, who was in the Air Force doing what he called time control research there. And we have a September 15th, 2009 WebBot report that independently predicted all of these things. So it's kind of what we call exotic science or frontier science, but we have a trend of independent whistleblowers coming out with what we can call new energy sciences with an ET connection. And I know that you tend to be more on the conservative end of the spectrum in this area, but I wondered if you could give us your comments on this story.
I will say this. From the standpoint of importance exopolitically, I happen to think that the very exotic stuff, which includes time travel and teleportation and what have you, is way too murky and not sufficiently supported yet to have that much impact on the exopolitical or the disclosure process. It's something that the insiders and the most interested in people in the public might bite into. But after that, it falls off exponentially. However, with respect to the energy, that is non-trivial. That's a little more significant. Here's why. We've been making a considerable effort to connect in order to demonstrate to the public why they should care about all of this and its outcome, right, to try to put it in terms that are concrete for them. We try to make a strong connection between the ET reality, the fact that the government has got crash vehicles that they have been studying and working with and working on for decades with unlimited budgets practically, and that they very likely, almost certainly, have made progress with the anti-gravitic concept of those craft, flying our own versions from time to time, which have been seen and talked about by insiders. And then we have to assume they have tried to make progress with understanding the energy systems of those craft, though it's much harder to know how much success they've had. Given the nature of the performance of these craft, it's not too difficult to assume that the energy systems are quite substantial, if not of an entirely new physics, which opens up the possibility that if they were, it could be incorporated in our world, it could allow us an energy source that would be profoundly, exponentially more effective and cheaper than what we have now. A dramatic decrease in energy costs and a breakthrough in energy physics would be transformative to the planet, because energy cost is probably the single most common factor to every component of human affairs. Almost nothing we do in any way, shape, or form is not significantly impacted by the cost of energy. You drop the cost of energy and you change the game completely. And many of the problems that we are faced with, which we're wringing our hands over, the solutions that are being put forward are wholly inadequate. And that's apparent. So this opens the possibility of some real solutions. So there's a lot at stake here. So consequently, there is a second track going on out there regarding this, quote, energy question. And it's simple. The very existence of these saucers and their performance capabilities has inspired a lot of people to say, okay, how do they work? And a lot of them are amateur scientists. Some of them are independent scientists, garage inventors, whatever you want to call them. There's a lot of geniuses out there that didn't go to Harvard. And they have been trying to come up with their idea of what they're doing. And a lot of this focuses on tapping into ground fields, space fields, because our own physics has determined that the actual energy component in complete empty space, what we call empty space, could be very great. This is the very edge of modern human physics. And so it's not unreasonable to think maybe we can get at that energy. There's also the speculation that they're going into another dimension, that this energy could be tapped, that's available in another dimension that we don't have generally have access to, which is convenient because it then would completely consistent with the conservation of energy law, which is a fairly strong law in human physics. Whatever. Devices are being made, typed up, talked about, websites are being created. You have all these people trying to gather these things together, and everybody's speculating about this engine, that engine, and these things have turned up from time to time. Some of them are bogus, some of them may not be. They're not. It's not really going anywhere, but it's created a lot of awareness on the part of people. The idea of the perpetual motion machine is no longer considered a joke, though perpetual motion is probably a misnomer. So this emergence of a kind of populist perception and focus on alternative energy, profound alternative energy, not windmills, is helping, I think, to spur the disclosure process. It's helping to alert people that, you know, if in fact that energy, an energy option like that is real, boy, let's get that technology. And I'll close the point with this. But one thing everybody that is addressing this issue needs to understand, and I can't overemphasize this. People can go do what they want, and just studying physics is worthwhile, and trying to invent a little device is very worthwhile. But when the government comes out with what they have done with the ET physics, I can assure you they are light years ahead of everything you're seeing on the Internet and all the garage inventors and the little engines that are being created by this company and that company. They are way, way past that. And so when that tech comes out, all of this other stuff will be nothing more than tchotchkes. They'll just disappear. So a lot of effort and time may go to waste, though the knowledge they gain in doing it may be useful to them to be part of the post-disclosure new world of physics invention, which will be rather profoundly advanced than where we are now. That's my thought on that.
Thank you. Okay. We have now gotten to the number one story.
Mm-hmm.
And if you will beg my indulgence. I would like to beg your indulgence.
Yeah, I think it's that way around.
Yeah. To just read to you the sort of frame that I started this number one story on.
Right.
And if you could deal with that frame and then go on to provide your own interpretation of what this frame was.
Sure.
The frame that I put on it was number one. The number one story is Barack Obama not disclosing the extraterrestrial presence is the top ET UFO story of 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked, is this the mother of all exopolitics stories of 2009? The gist of this story is that official state extraterrestrial disclosure by the U.S. Commander-in-Chief did not take place in 2009 despite numerous pressures within his own administration and military establishment to disclose. The current phase of extraterrestrial state disclosure, end of quote, began with a series of high-profile public UFO sightings, such as the January 2008 Stephenville, Texas, overflight which flew over the Crawford White House, Texas White House, unopposed by U.S. military aircraft. Subsequent to that, a high-level military delegation, we now know from a U.S. naval officer alleged, called Source A, which a colleague of ours, Dr. Michael Sala, has detailed, brought together a series of meetings of about 40 or so UN officials from various countries, including the Vatican and the UK, who determined a new spirit of openness. But it was all triggered by the January 8, 2008 Stephenville overflight. That's kind of what triggered this wave of, and now the latest wave or the latest report, according to Dr. Sala, is that Source A says that he and the military intelligence are meeting, quote, with the reptilians, the grays, and the conformers, and that they've been on their ships, and they're continuing the pressure from the inside. So this is all very exotic stuff. I mean, there's a lot of problems, some people say, around the reptilians and the grays, because supposed secret agreements which result in the whole abduction thing, which may be high crimes and misdemeanors according to the Constitution. So I wondered if you could address what you think the number one story was around the disclosure issue and Obama and how that played out in 2009.
I would agree. I believe that the number one story in 2009 is not what happened, but what didn't happen, and that the disclosure did not happen, and that is the number one story, which means, of course, we should talk about it. With respect to a lot of this concomitant information, included in the assessment in this article, as you've just discussed, I don't know about that. It's pretty murky, and while I'm aware of some of these details and some of these claims, my opinion, they have not been confirmed to a level that they can have what I consider dramatic exopolitical impact. So, but I mean, everybody can speculate why it didn't happen in 2009, and I will right now. And everyone has a right to include whatever they want in that. I tend to approach it in a much more basic way, and I don't necessarily connect it to stuff that I consider too far removed from the processes that I see going on. It doesn't mean that they're not connected. They may very well be. I have no idea, for instance, whether the sighting in Stephenville at the beginning of the year triggered anything, right? But others may think it did. So, again, I can't really speak to those. However, here's what I know did happen. We know that there was a great deal, I've discussed extensively what is transpiring going all the way back to 1991 in the Rockefeller Initiative under Bill Clinton, and then the comments by John Podesta in 2002-2003, and then Bill Richardson's comments in 2004, the announcement of the new Apollo project to create a new deal program to bring America back around and on its feet again in 2004 that was then shelved. This is a new high-tech new deal. Resurgence for America, billions of dollars into green jobs, green invention, green everything, all shelved, and pretty much shelved. So that we do know. And I felt the indications were that Obama was going to be the disclosure president, not because he was going to stomp on down to the Pentagon and demand to see the evidence and the bodies or whatever else, and then grab a bunch of military intelligence guys by the ear and frog march them up to the White House and make them disclose. No, the president doesn't have that power. The founding fathers saw fit not to give the executive branch an army. And so if the military intelligence management of this issue doesn't want to cooperate, there's not a damn thing the president can do. That's pretty much been the case since Kennedy. But I felt he was going to disclose because they want him to, and he's acceptable to them, and he's certainly probably more than happy to do it. But the decision will come from down deep, and he will simply be told, you're it, and unless he wants to put up a fight, he will end up disclosing. That's how I believe it would happen. And Obama was acceptable, and the timing was right. We needed to get it done, but it didn't happen. Why? The best explanation I can give is this. I had a good idea what the Democrats' plans were, and I felt that that the new Apollo project was going to be probably a very well received. When you announce that Green Development New Deal program, then you disclose the ET presence and then start talking about and bringing out the ET technology. You put that into that New Deal program, and you've got yourself a total renaissance of America, as well as a global renaissance, as that technology is spreads out and is available elsewhere. But it didn't happen. And the principal reason it didn't happen is that the Republicans, who are serious political hardball players, I think, knew very well. First of all, Republicans know there's an ET presence. And I think they knew about the new Apollo project. There was a press conference held at the National Press Club. And so they knew what was coming. And I think they saw that, boy, if that all falls into place, if he starts a major New Deal high-tech renaissance program for the U.S., then it discloses the ET presence for that historical legacy and brings out ET technology, we won't be in the White House again until the next century. And so they who decided to play some serious hardball. Now, what could they do to upset that apple cart? Putting a couple nasty editorials in the Washington Times, I don't think was going to cut it. And so what they did, in my view, is that they went to see their buddies down on Wall Street, and they said, you know, you guys have pushed this to the limit. You're all pretty much at the end of the line. You screwed up the system, and some of you, maybe probably Lehman Brothers, is going to go bankrupt or go under any day now. So if you go under now, we'll crank up a multi-billion dollar bailout, and we'll just shove money at Wall Street like crazy, and you can then pass that on to the foreign banks you owe money to, and everybody will be copacetic. On the other hand, if you tread water for another few months and go bankrupt or go down under the Democrats, you just may end up in jail. And so they basically set the financial house on fire and drained the Treasury and put us into economic crisis, much more than we would have, I think, had this thing gone in a different way. In other words, they triggered the crisis in order to start the money flow before Obama or the Democrats even got in the White House. This is why it happened in late October. They knew they were going to lose the election. Trust me, there was no chance they were going to win that election, and every Republican operative knew that by early October. So they made a dramatic move, and by doing that, when the Democrats arrive in the White House, there's a massive financial crisis going on. The debt is about to go to the moon. Hundreds of billions of dollars are already out the door, and they're not only their apple cart upset, but this bailout is so far along that they almost have to go along with it. That if they try to reverse course at that point, they probably do sink the ship of state. And so the Republicans really put the screws to the Democrats, and everything that was on the Democrat agenda was essentially put into a cocked hat. And one of the things that got nailed was the disclosure.
Yeah, good.
Are you following me?
Yes. Right. That is a very deep and a very creative interpretation. Just because of time, I'm going to ask you, we're going to take a brief break here, and we will be back. This is Exopolitics Radio. We're with Steve Bassett, who's the executive director of XPAC and the Paradigm Research Group. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Please stay tuned.